in the first reading. The prophet Jeremiah says, "Woe to the shepherds who mislead and scatter the flock of my pasture." Woe to the shepherds. You have not cared for my people, and I will take care to punish your evil deeds. Woe to the shepherds. Who's God speaking about in this reading? Who are the shepherds of Israel? Ordinary folks? Say what? The rabbis? Probably no rabbis at that time, but yes, the religious leaders of the people, who also happened to be the political leaders of the people in those days. This woe is directed against the Jewish leaders, the priests, the political leaders, all rolled up into one. There are bad ones who have led the people astray, and God condemns them and will punish them and replace them with good leaders. There are two things, I think, that are going on. One is that this reading is part of creating an expectation of what this good shepherd might look like. So it's creating a messianic expectation of what is to come, because the reading continues, "I will bring forth a shoot from Jesse who will lead your people with justice and bring them good things." But that's off into the future. So it creates an expectation in the minds of the people of this good shepherd still to come. The other thing that goes on here, it seems to me, is that it makes clear that God cares deeply about what God's people experience in this life here and now. God expects justice for God's people now. Food for God's people now. Shelter. All sorts of good care. This is part of God's desire for God's people. It isn't just a matter of, "Don't worry, because in the next life everything will be just fine." Yes, everything will be fine in the next life, but God wants good things for God's people here and now, and God says it is the responsibility of the leaders of the community to see that those good things are in the hands of all men and women, not just some. Now, in our day, we have a distinction between civic government and religious government. So things get a little bit more complicated. And in fact, I think the history of the church could probably be understood as the history of the relationship between church and state, between religious officials, religious life, and political or civic life. And if you look at the history of the church over those 2,000 years, we're all over the place, right? In some eras, we were identified with the local government. In other areas, we were kicked out and entirely excluded from any involvement in political life. So we're still struggling to figure out how that works. I mean, even in today's newspapers, we're still dealing with this issue of how to balance religious authority, the demands of the gospel, with political authority, with a pluralistic democratic government. Religious liberty is a big topic these days. What are the appropriate limits on government intervention in religious affairs? What are the appropriate limits on the exercise of religious faith? What's the appropriate role of the church in political life? Francis is all over the newspapers in this regard. So it might be helpful to sort of look back on what the recent teaching of the church is with regard to some of these questions. I think it might be helpful to us in trying to figure this difficult tension out among ourselves. In Vatican II, in the Church in the Modern World and in the Religious Liberty Decree, the church makes it clear that the purpose of civil government is to promote the common good. Say that again. The purpose of political government, the civic community, political leaders, if you will, is to promote the common good. And the church says that's the whole justification, the only justification, if you will, for political government. And so, the common good, excuse me, I got lost. The common good is the sum total of those conditions that are necessary for all men and women to have what they need to flourish. It's that sum total of all conditions that all men and women need in order to flourish. Not just some, but all men and women. So the concern is, who's getting left out? And what can we do to make sure that they have what they need to thrive? And this common good includes religious liberty. That's part of what makes a human complete, fulfilled, the right to exercise one's religious belief. It goes on to say that the church and the state share this interest. This is a common interest between the church and the state. Both parties are interested in the common good, but each works in a little bit different area, right? And it goes on to say that the political community has a proper autonomy in things temporal. It's right and proper that the political community has an autonomy in order to do what it decides is appropriate for the common good. In other words, the church shouldn't interfere in what is properly the responsibility of the political government. Of course, the same goes in the other direction. The government ought not to interfere in what is properly a religious matter. And the church is not committed, the council says very clearly, the church is not committed to any particular political or economic or social system. That's for you and I to decide in our political deliberations. So individuals and groups have a right to religious beliefs and to exercise those religious beliefs, provided that exercise does not interfere with the just and proper public order. There's a limit to the exercise of religious freedom, in other words. my exercise of religious freedom cannot interfere with the proper good order of this community. On the other hand, the state has the right to protect itself from interference, from the abuses that are done in the name of religion. The state has the right to protect itself from abuses that may be done in the name of religion, provided the state is acting fairly, without favoritism, and not arbitrarily. Do you see these two groups trying to find ways to live together in harmony, each with its own proper autonomy, each with its own particular area of concern? But what both have in common is that both ought to be working always and everywhere for the common good. And that's how we judge whether a political system is operating according to the gospel or not. That's the only justification for a political community, is that the political community then acts to ensure the common good of all people. So how should a Christian participate in public life? Just a few quotes here. This is from the Church in the Modern World. Every citizen ought to be mindful of his right and duty to promote the common good by using his vote. When we vote, vote on the basis of which candidate we believe will best promote the common good. Citizens should cultivate a generous and loyal spirit of patriotism, but without narrow-mindedness, so that they will always keep in mind the welfare of the whole human family, not just Americans. Christians must be conscious of their specific and proper role in the political community. They should be a shining example by their sense of responsibility and their dedication to the common good. We ought to be an example by the way we live our lives, by the choices that we make, an example to the government, the political community, the civic community, of how to care for our brothers and sisters. Christians should recognize the legitimacy of differing points of view about the organization of worldly affairs and show respect for their fellow citizens. Political parties, for their part, must support whatever in their opinion is conducive to the common good and must never put their interests before the common good. If you remember one thing about today's first reading and what God desires for God's people, it is that all of us have a responsibility, both within the church and within our neighborhood communities, our civic community. We have a common responsibility for caring for all men and women. And our participation in that community always ought to be directed toward this common good. This is complicated stuff. But remember who it is who's getting excluded from the benefits of our common life together.